Radiolab is supported by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call the shots on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
Radiolab is supported by Dana-Farber Cancer Institute. What if we could block a protein to stop runaway cell division? Dana-Farber laid the foundation for CDK4/6 inhibitors, drugs that are increasing the survival rate for many advanced breast cancers. Learn more at danafarber.org/everywhere.
Listener supported, WNYC Studios.
Wait, you're listening.
Okay.
All right.
Okay.
All right.
You're listening to Radiolab.
Radiolab.
From
WNYC.
See?
Yeah.
And NPR.
Hello, David.
Yes, hello.
This is Pat.
Oh, hi, Pat.
How are you? Let's begin with this story from our producer, Pat Walters.
Pat, go ahead.
Okay, so I heard this one from this guy named David.
My name is David Buss.
Two S's. He's a psychology professor
at the University of Texas at Austin.
And this particular story, it comes from a book that David wrote. Could you just tell me the little story that you begin your book with?
Okay, yes. This is one of the things that's this was one of the things that sparked my interest in the topic of murder.
The whole thing happened several years ago.
I had a very good friend.
Another professor at the university.
And I used to socialize with him and his wife. And one evening they were throwing a party and invited me over. And so when I went to the party, a party was already in full swing and I got there, walked in and asked his wife where this friend of mine was. And she got a disgusted look on her face and said that he was up in the bedroom. And so I went up to the bedroom to find him, and he was in a rage.
In a rage? How? Like, you walk into the room, what do you find?
Well, he started fuming that his wife had dissed him. And
what did she do?
She expressed disapproval about his clothing choices.
She made fun of his shirt or something.
But did it publicly in front of her friends. So it was a kind of he felt publicly humiliated.
And while David's sitting in the bedroom with this friend, the guy looks up at him and he says,
I'm going to kill her.
How did he say it? Like quietly or?
Like through his teeth, I'm going to kill her.
David had always known this guy to be pretty mild-mannered.
But he is a large, very strong man. With a black belt in karate, I knew what he was capable of. So I suggested that we go out for a walk, and I basically spent the next half hour walking around with him trying to cool him off.
And eventually, he did.
He just calmed down.
Hmm. And did you go back to the party then and, like, continue dinner partying for a while?
Yeah, I did.
And he did too?
Yes, and he did too. And then he seemed fine when I said goodbye to him. He seemed calm, and I left and went home. And then it was several hours later in the middle of the night that I got the call.
And it was his friend.
And he says, can I come over and sleep on your couch? If I don't leave my house right now, I'm going to kill her. He was in this state of fury, he said, and instead of hitting his wife, he smashed his fist into the bathroom mirror and then realized that he had to leave the house or he was going to do damage to her.
And so he says that and you're like, okay, yes, come over now. Like,
yeah, exactly.
Meanwhile, later that night on the other side of town,
his wife went into hiding. Literally disappeared for 6 months and didn't tell anyone where she was because she was terrified that he was going to kill her.
This story made us wonder, is David's friend...
Is he unusual? Or...
Does everybody at some point have something dark in them that just tiptoes out, just from time to time?
Yeah. This is Radiolab, and today, we're gonna get bad, so to speak.
We've done a good show.
This is the bad show.
So you ask, like, why do people do bad things?
What does it actually mean to be bad anyways? Like, how do you tell the real baddies from the rest of us?
That's our hour.
I'm Jad Abumrad.
I'm Robert Krowich.
This is Radiolab.
The Bad Show.
Okay, so what happened to David that night with his friend got him really curious about murder and badness and all these things we're thinking about. But it wasn't until a few years later that he learned something that really put what happened that night into context. By this point, David's moved on to a new university, and he's teaching an introductory psychology class.
And I devoted one class session to the topic of homicide and why people kill. And I designed a little questionnaire where I simply asked the students, you know, have you ever thought about killing someone? And they would circle yes or no.
Then he left some space at the bottom for them to elaborate if they said yes.
And, you know, the class ended and I went back to my office and I just sat at my desk and I started reading these. And I was just astonished
to find page after page of yeses, and not just yeses,
but these very vivid descriptions about
who they would kill, where they do it, when,
the precise method.
How many of them went into that kind of detail?
I would say 75 or 80%.
Wow. Were you a little bit like horrified? Like, oh my God, my students are murderers.
Horrified is I was pretty stunned. And so I expanded the sample where we asked about 5,000 people.
All over the world.
Singapore, Peru, the UK.
That same question.
Have you ever thought about killing someone? And 91% of the men said yes, and 84% of the women.
Said yes, I've thought about killing someone.
Yes. If any sizable fraction actually acted on their homicidal fantasies, the streets would be running red.
Yeah, but that's just, those are fantasies.
Some of them actually seem like,
well, here's one,
something more than just fantasies.
From a woman.
Sure.
Okay, this is a 20-year-old female. We ask, who did you think about killing? And she said, my ex-boyfriend. We lived together for a couple months. He was very aggressive. He started calling me a whore and told me he didn't love me anymore. So I broke up with him. Then a few months later, he started calling me trying to get back together, but I didn't want to. He said that if I ever had a relationship with another man, he was going to send videos of us having sex to all the people in my university. The thing is that I do have a new boyfriend, but my ex-boyfriend doesn't know that yet, and I'm terrified that he'll do what he says. Then suddenly the thought occurred to me that my life would be much happier without him in existence. And then she said, I actually did this. I invited him for dinner, and as he was in the kitchen, looking stupid, peeling the carrots to make salad, I came up to him laughingly, gently, so that he wouldn't suspect anything. I thought about grabbing a knife quickly and stabbing him in the chest repeatedly until he was dead. I actually did the first thing, but he saw my intentions and ran away. When we asked how close she came to killing him, she estimated 60%.
Well, 60.
I don't think I've ever had a fantasy that anatomically specific, where I would see the part of the other person that I was going to stab or plan it like that.
Well, have you ever been blackmailed the way this woman was being blackmailed?
No, no one has ever sent about a sex tape that I've ever, you know.
So you don't know. It is a fair question to ask, what are the conditions under which you or me or any of us could do awful things?
I think they'd have to be extreme in the extreme.
Well,
because you know how mild-mannered I am.
No. And you know what? This actually brings us to our first stop of the hour. So let me, just to set it up, Robert, I'm going to give you this piece of paper here.
What is this?
So these are some word pairs. So read these words that you see
these
there.
Words here?
Yep.
Nice day.
Uh-huh.
Fat neck.
Yep.
Sad face. What is it? Soft hair?
Yep.
I don't know what this is.
These are just word pairs. I want you to commit them to memory.
Commit them to memory? You know.
And while you're doing that, just give me your finger. I'm going to connect this little electrode to your finger. There we go. Right there.
Stop.
Just
wait a second. Clear air.
Okay, so give me the paper back.
Already?
Time's up. So I'm just going to go into this other room over here.
Can you hear me?
What?
All right, so I'm going to talk to you over this intercom, okay?
Okay.
I'm going to give you a test.
I'm not ready for this.
Pay attention.
All right.
To the best of your memory, which word was matched with nice? Was it nice day, nice sky, nice job, or nice chair?
Days.
Answer, please.
I don't know. Wait a second.
Just push the button that corresponds to the right word. Go.
Okay, I'm choosing job?
Wrong. Answer is day.
Sorry, man.
285 volts.
I'm going to have to give you a little,
What did you just do?
She just burst my eardrums. God. Obviously, no need to be alarmed. That was not a real shock. We were just enacting an old, very famous experiment that you may have heard about.
It is May 1962.
Done by this guy.
An experiment is being conducted in the Elegant Interaction Laboratory at Yale University.
That's Stanley Milgram talking about the experiment in a film. In case you've never heard of this, you probably have, but in case you haven't, here's what he did. He recruited a bunch of subjects.
The subjects are 40 males between the ages of 20 and 50.
Just normal, everyday dudes.
The subjects range in occupation from corporation presidents to good humor men and plumbers.
And he ran them through something like what you and I just did.
Right.
He would have each subject sit down at a table.
Have a seat right here.
In front of this really impressive-looking machine.
This machine.
It had lots of switches on it.
Generates electric shocks. And when you press one of the switches all the way down, the learner gets a shock.
And in the other room, there was a guy who he called the learner, who was supposed to have memorized some words. And every time that guy got a word wrong, like you just did,
yep,
which happened constantly,
answer his neck.
The volunteer
300 volts.
Was instructed to shock that guy with higher and higher voltage. Now, the volunteer couldn't see the guy he was shocking, but he could definitely hear him. Milgram staged the whole thing like it was some experiment about memory and punishment, but of course it wasn't about that.
Continue, please.
It was about how far would these people go? How many times would they shock that sad sap in the next room just because they were being told to?
Let me out of here. Let me out
the guy
here.
Yelling, of course, was an actor, and the shocks weren't real, but the questions in the air at the time were very real.
Prosecution, the Attorney General.
This was a moment when human cruelty was on trial. Quite literally.
When I stand before you, judges of Israel, in this court, to accuse Adolf Eichmann, I do not stand alone.
So Stanley Milgram actually begins these experiments the same year that Adolf Eichmann goes on trial for Nazi war crimes.
That's radio producer Ben Walker. He'll be our guide for this segment.
And in the trial, when the prosecutors essentially ask him how you came to commit genocide, he would say over and over again,
it was not my personal affair.
I was just following orders.
I had to do what I was ordered.
And it's this defense. This is basically what Stanley Milgram set out to test
285 volts
in a lab at Yale University with a bunch of regular Americans.
Like, is that something that's universal?
Yeah.
Or just an Eichmann thing?
Yeah. He figured maybe 1% of these men would keep flicking the switches up to the highest voltage, but that's not what he found. 65%
continue, please.
Were willing to shock their fellow citizens over and over again, even past when they were screaming in pain.
Something's happened to that man in there.
Even when they stopped screaming?
Yeah, when they were maybe dead.
You better check in on him, sir. He won't answer you nothing.
Please continue. Go on, please.
They continued shocking their corpses. His experiment remains one of the most famous experiments of the 20th century.
In 1962, Stanley Milgram shocked the world with his study on obedience.
It is still trotted out to explain everything from hazing to war crimes.
What is there in human nature?
To gang behavior.
That allows an individual to act inhumanely.
Genocide.
Harshly, severely.
It's like a downloadable from the internet instant defense for doing wrong. But if you look at Milgram's work closely.
Yeah.
Like this guy did.
Alex Haslam, professor of psychology at the University of Exeter.
Then a different picture will emerge.
Really, that story has been told a million and one times for the last 50 years. We've just got to get over it.
Now, what you need to understand about Alex Haslam is that he hates it when interviewers only want to talk about the baseline study.
The one that everybody knows, the so-called baseline.
The 65% one.
The one we just talked about.
Yeah.
So there's more? There's more to it?
Yeah. Because actually, he studied between 20 and 40 different variants of this same paradigm.
Stanley Milgram took electric shocks very seriously. He did this experiment a bunch of times and in a bunch of different ways.
He had all sorts of different things.
He would change where the shocker and the shockee sat.
He had women participants. He had an experimenter who wasn't a scientist but was a member of the general public.
And every scenario produced a different result.
Really?
Yep.
I've got in front of me, I've just got the data from the Milgram study. Let me just get that out. I mean,
so again, the baseline study is the one where 65% of the volunteers
go all the way.
Highest dose of electricity.
XXX.
But in experiment number three, if they put the shockee in the same room with the shocker, so the shocker could actually see the person that he's shocking.
Obedience drops to about 40%.
And in experiment number four, when the teacher has to hold the learner's hand down
on a plate
in order him to feel the shocks,
it drops to about 30%.
Wow. Experiment 14.
If the experimenter is not a scientist, but is an ordinary man,
not wearing a white coat,
obedience drops to 20%.
Oh.
Really?
Well, how low can we go?
Okay.
Here's another one.
This variant.
Experiment 17.
There's you and there's two other participants.
Both actors.
If those two participants refuse to go on.
Like saying, like, I don't want to kill a guy.
Only 10% under those circumstances go on. And then the final one.
Experiment 15.
Of course, normally you just have one experimenter who's giving you these instructions.
But if you put two experimenters in the room and
they start disagreeing with each other. And this one, you get 0% going all the
zero.
Way.
Zero?
Zero in that condition.
You said zero.
None
like
go right to the
absolute
end. No,
zero.
Not one person.
No one.
No.
Not a soul.
Exactly 0%.
Well, all right. I'm starting to feel a little bit better about my fellow man.
One second. Hey. Shh. Okay.
Where is he?
I'm in a closet.
You're in a closet?
Because this room is echoey, and you know, there's nothing like a closet full of clothes to like help balance that out.
That's true. All right, so keep going.
So you see, it's just in that one experiment that 65% of people are willing to go all the way.
Yeah.
But in all of these other scenarios, they don't. And even when they do say yes, even when they go along with the experiment, as you can see in the film, they struggle.
Continue using the last switch on the board, please.
I'm not getting no answer.
Please continue. The next word is white.
They have debates with themselves.
You think you should look in on them, please?
Debates with the experimenter.
Not once we've started the experiment.
But what if something's happened and they had an attack or something in there?
The experiment requires that we continue. Go on, please.
Don't demands help mean anything?
Whether the learner likes it or not, we
but
must.
But he might be dead in there.
What's interesting is that how all of these struggles, all of them,
please continue,
play out the same way. It's the experimenter
on,
prodding the shockers along.
You're going to keep giving them what, 450 volts every shot now?
That's correct.
For me, it's all about the prods.
The next word is white.
This is what totally pulled me into this story.
The prods.
Stanley Milgram had four scripted prods that he wrote out for his experimenters.
For when the subjects didn't want to continue?
Yep. The first one was, please go on.
Continue, please.
And if they didn't go on, if they resisted, the experimenter would break out prod number two. The experiment requires that you continue.
Well, the experiment requires
that you
continue.
Well, I mean, I know it does, sir, but I mean, he's up to 195 volts.
And if they still were resisting or struggling, they'd get prod number three.
It's absolutely essential that you continue.
It's absolutely essential
that you continue.
It's a little bit more direct.
It's a bit stronger, but it's not an order.
Not quite.
But the fourth prod.
Really, the critical fourth prod.
Is an absolute order. The fourth prod is.
You have no other choice, teacher.
You have no other choice, teacher.
You must continue.
That is definitely an order.
Exactly.
But every time the experimenter pulled out the fourth prod, and this was confirmed when the experiment was redone in 2006. Total disobedience.
Total disobedience?
Anytime the experimenter said, you must continue, the shocker would say, hell no, I don't.
You had no other choice, teacher.
I don't have a choice. I'm not going to go ahead with it.
Well, we'll have to discontinue the experiment then.
I'm sorry.
Here's another one.
We had no other choice. You must
go. Yes, I have a choice.
That is, if you don't continue, we're going to have to discontinue the experiment.
We'll have to. He says cut it out. After all, he knows what he can stand. That's my opinion. That's where I'm going to stand on it.
Wow, so the subjects seem willing to shock another human being, but as soon as you say it's an order...
They don't do it.
Huh.
Now, that's important. It's very important, because if you ask university undergraduates, what does the Milgram study show? They will invariably say something like, they show that people obey orders. Okay. Well, actually, the one thing that the study really doesn't show is that people obey orders. And it's a pretty big thing to miss. It's a pretty big thing to miss, isn't it, really?
So wait, if it doesn't show that people are just obeying orders,
yeah,
then what does it show?
Okay, I think it's like this.
All right, let's go on to our instructions. We will begin with this test.
The participants are there in the study.
Each pair of words in
They've got a very plausible, very credible, high-status scientist in a high-status scientific institution.
Yale.
Who is going to do this powerful piece of science.
Direct your voice toward that microphone as the room...
So they sit down in the chair thinking, wow, this is really important. I'm about to help this quest for knowledge. I really want to do a good job.
Now, as we sort of know in life, lots of things that we do, if they're worthwhile doing, are not always easy. And you find yourself in a situation where you've got to do something that's hard.
Like shocking an innocent stranger over and over.
But if you think that's the right thing, if you think that science is worth pursuing, you say, okay, I'll go along with this.
So you're saying they're shocking these people because they thought it was worthwhile?
Look, the participants, you know, they're not, it's not just blind obedience. Oh, you tell me, sir. Yes, sir. No, sir. Three bags full, sir.
Answer, please.
They're engaged with the task. They're trying to be good participants.
Are you all right?
They're trying to do the right thing. They're not doing something because they have to. They're doing it because they think they ought to. And that's all the difference in the world.
420 volts.
Suddenly I'm thinking this is actually a darker interpretation than the original.
Absolutely darker.
Because they are doing it.
No question about it.
They have the agency.
Yep.
And they think it's right. Although clearly on some level they know it isn't.
There's a sort of chilling comparison, which is a speech that Himmler gave to the SS, some SS leaders, when they were about to commit a range of atrocities. He said, look, this is what you're going to do is, of course you don't want to do this. Of course nobody wants to be killing other people. And we realize this is hard work. But what you're doing is for the good of Germany, and this is necessary in order to advance our noble cause.
Wow. So then...
Hey, wait, I'm almost done, guys. Give me two more minutes.
So in the Milgram case...
Uh-huh.
Well, if the idea is that people will do bad if they think it's good, like it's a good, noble cause, well, what's the noble cause in this case?
Science. You can see this in the surveys that the men filled out after the experiments were over.
This was exactly what was on my mind. If the experiment had to be successful, it had to be carried on.
The questionnaires they filled out are part of the Milgram archive at Yale.
Willing to help in a worthwhile experiment.
And it's kind of surprising. A lot of them are really positive, even though they've just been told that they were duped.
Research in any field is a must, particularly in this day and age. Do you think that more studies of this sort should be carried out? Definitely yes.
We, as onlookers to the study, we have this kind of godlike sort of vision of like, well, of course what they're doing is wrong. But if it looked at from another perspective, there is a sense in which you could celebrate what they're doing. I'm not suggesting one should, but I'm just saying there is a sense in which these people are prepared to do something that's very painful to them and to someone else because they want to promote science. Well, you know, you can see that's a good thing. I mean, you know,
what
I'm giving...
God, because it's like we started with this experiment that we all... see as evidence of humans' latent capacity for evil.
Yeah.
And you tell us, actually, no, under some circumstances, we don't do the bad thing we're told to do because, here's another flip, we don't have to be told. In fact, we hate being told, but we will do it on our own if we think it's good.
Yeah.
Now you're saying, actually, that you could read that very dark fact as being actually evidence of something quite...
Yeah.
Quite noble.
Well, if you dressed it up and if you just had some minor variants of the paradigm, you could presumably make this out. These are people who are incredibly noble. They are. I mean, it's the fact, of course, that they're administering pain to a stranger. That's what's horrifying about it. But imagine they were administering pain to themselves. Imagine they really were, had to administer shocks themselves or something. But if they were prepared to do that, when I suspect a lot of them would, then we'd say these are people who really believe in science. And isn't this a good thing that we have people in our society who are willing to make sacrifices
wow.
for the greater good?
Hmm. So in the end, where do you come down? Do you leave this experiment in a light mood or in a dark mood?
I would say in a powerful mood. We're close to some really fundamental truths about human nature. And, you know, my views about human nature are that it affords infinite potential for lightness and dark. There's lots and lots of lessons here. But one is, I think, you know, when you're enjoined to do something for the greater good, maybe ask yourself the question, what is greater and what is good?
Oh, well, that right there, I've slapped some quotations around that.
Yeah.
Our thanks to Ben Walker, whose podcast, he has a podcast and it's a good one. It's called Too Much Information.
Yes, it's awesome. Thank you, Ben. And also thank you to Alex Haslam, professor of psychology at the University of Exeter. We'll be right back.
Start of message.
Okay, here goes. Take one. My name is Benjamin Walker, and here are some Radiolab credits.
Radiolab is supported in part by the National Science Foundation and the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation.
Enhancing public understanding of science and technology in the modern world.
More information about Sloan at www.sloan.org.
Radiolab is produced by WNYC
and distributed by NPR.
Voila! And I'm hanging up.
Bye.
On Notes from America, we have conversations with people across the country about how we can truly become the nation that we claim to be. Each week, we talk about race, our politics, education, relationships, usually all of them, because everything's connected. And you, our listeners, are at the center of those conversations. I'm Kai Wright. Join me on Notes from America, wherever you get your podcasts.